As the miles clicked past them, the towns went by, with the stations at which they did not stop, with the crowds of people who had come only to see, to cheer, and to hope. She saw garlands of flowers under the sooted eaves of old station buildings, and bunting of red, white, and blue on the time-eaten walls. It was like the pictures she had seen, and envied, in schoolbook histories of railroads, from the era when people gathered to greet the first run of a train. It was like the age when Nat Taggart moved across the country, and the stops along his way were marked by men eager for the sight of achievement. That age, she had thought, was gone. Generations had passed, with no event to greet anywhere, with nothing to see but the cracks lengthening year by year on the walls built by Nat Taggart. Yet men came again, as they had come in his time, drawn by the same response. She glanced at Reardon. He stood against the wall, unaware of the crowds, indifferent to admiration. He was watching the performance of track and train with an expert's intensity of professional interest. His bearing suggested that he would kick aside as irrelevant any thought such as, "They like it," when the thought ringing in his mind was, "It works." His tall figure in the single gray of slacks and shirt looked as if his body were stripped for action. The slacks stressed the long lines of his legs, the light firm posture of standing without effort, or being ready to swing forward at an instant's notice. The short sleeves stressed the gaunt strength of his arms. The open shirt bared the tight skin of his chest. She turned away, realizing suddenly that she had been glancing back at him too often. But this day had no ties to past or future. Her thoughts were cut off from implications. She saw no further meaning, only the immediate intensity of the feeling that she was imprisoned with him, sealed together in the same cube of air, the closeness of his presence underscoring her awareness of this day, as his rails underscored the flight of the train. She turned deliberately and glanced back. He was looking at her. He did not turn away, but held her glance, coldly and with full intention. She smiled defiantly, not letting herself know the full meaning of her smile, knowing only that it was the sharpest blow she could strike at his inflexible face. She felt a sudden desire to see him trembling, to tear a cry out of him. She turned her head away slowly, feeling a reckless amusement, wondering why she found it difficult to breathe. She sat leaning back in her chair, looking ahead, knowing that he was as aware of her as she was of him. She found pleasure in the special self-consciousness it gave her. When she crossed her legs, when she leaned on her arm against the windowsill, when she brushed her hair off her forehead, every movement of her body was underscored by a feeling the unadmitted words for which were, "Is he seeing it?" The towns had been left behind. The track was rising through a country growing more grimly reluctant to permit approach. The rails kept vanishing behind curves, and the ridges of hills kept moving closer, as if the plains were being folded into pleats. The flat stone shelves of Colorado were advancing to the edge of the track, and the distant reaches of the sky were shrinking into waves of bluish mountains. Far ahead they saw a mist of smoke over factory chimneys, then the web of a power station, and the lone needle of a steel structure. They were approaching Denver. She glanced at Pat Logan. He was leaning forward a little farther. She saw a slight tightening in the fingers of his hand and in his eyes. He knew, as she did, the danger of crossing a city at the speed they were traveling. It was a succession of minutes, but it hit them as a single whole. First they saw the lone shapes, which were factories, rolling across their window panes. Then the shapes fused into the blur of streets. Then a delta of rails spread out before them like the mouth of a funnel, sucking them into the Taggart station, with nothing to protect them but the small green beads of light scattered over the ground. From the height of the cab, they saw boxcars on sidings streak past as flat ribbons of rooftops. The black hole of the train shed flew at their faces. They hurtled through an explosion of sound, the beating of wheels against the glass panes of a vault, and the screams of cheering from a mass that swayed like a liquid in the darkness among steel columns. They flew toward a glowing arch, and the green lights hanging in the open sky beyond, the green lights that were like the doorknobs of space, throwing door after door open before them. Then vanishing behind them went the streets clotted with traffic, the open windows bulging with human figures, the screaming sirens, and from the top of a distant skyscraper, a cloud of paper snowflakes shimmering on the air, flung by someone who saw the passage of a silver bullet across a city stopped still to watch it. Then they were out again, on a rocky grade, and with shocking suddenness, the mountains were before them, as if the city had flung them straight at a granite wall, and a thin ledge had caught them in time. They were clinging to the side of a vertical cliff with the earth rolling down, dropping away, and giant tiers of twisted boulders streaming up and shutting out the sun, leaving them to speed through a bluish twilight, with no sight of soil or sky. The curves of rail became coiling circles among walls that advanced to grind them off their sides. But the track cut through at times, and the mountains parted, flaring open like two wings at the tip of the rail, one wing green, made of vertical needles, with whole pines serving as the pile of a solid carpet, the other reddish-brown, made of naked rock. She looked down through the open window and saw the silver side of the engine hanging over empty space. Far below, the thin thread of a stream went falling from ledge to ledge, and the ferns that drooped to the water were the shimmering tops of birch trees. She saw the engine's tail of boxcars winding along the face of a granite drop, and miles of contorted stone below. She saw the coils of a green-blue rail unwinding behind the train. A wall of rock shot upward in their path, filling the windshield, darkening the cab, so close that it seemed as if the remnant of time could not let them escape it. But she heard the screech of wheels on curve. The light came bursting back, and she saw an open stretch of rail on a narrow shelf. The shelf ended in space. The nose of the engine was aimed straight at the sky. There was nothing to stop them but two strips of green-blue metal strung in a curve along the shelf. To take the pounding violence of 16 motors, she thought, the thrust of 7,000 tons of steel and freight, to withstand it, grip it, and swing it around a curve, was the impossible feat performed by two strips of metal no wider than her arm. What made it possible? What power had given to an unseen arrangement of molecules, the power on which their lives depended, and the lives of all the men who waited for the 80 boxcars? She saw a man's face and hands in the glow of a laboratory oven, over the white liquid of a sample of metal. She felt the sweep of an emotion which she could not contain, as of something bursting upward. She turned to the door of the motor units. She threw it open to a screaming jet of sound and escaped into the pounding of the engine's heart. For a moment, it was as if she were reduced to a single sense, the sense of hearing. And what remained of her hearing was only a long, rising, falling, rising scream. She stood in a swaying, sealed chamber of metal, looking at the giant generators. She had wanted to see them, because the sense of triumph within her was bound to them, to her love for them, to the reason of the life work she had chosen. In the abnormal clarity of a violent emotion, she felt as if she were about to grasp something she had never known and had to know. She laughed aloud, but heard no sound of it. Nothing could be heard through the continuous explosion. "The John Galt line," she shouted, for the amusement of feeling her voice swept away from her lips. She moved slowly along the length of the motor units down a narrow passage between the engines and the wall. She felt the immodesty of an intruder, as if she had slipped inside a living creature, under its silver skin, and were watching its life beating in gray metal cylinders, in twisted coils, in sealed tubes, in the convulsive whirl of blades in wire cages. The enormous complexity of the shape above her was drained by invisible channels, and the violence raging within it was led to fragile needles on glass dials, to green and red beads winking on panels, to tall thin cabinets stenciled high voltage. Why had she always felt that joyous sense of confidence when looking at machines, she thought. In these giant shapes, two aspects pertaining to the inhuman were radiantly absent, the causeless and the purposeless. Every part of the motors was an embodied answer to why and what for, like the steps of a life course chosen by the sort of mind she worshipped. The motors were a moral code cast in steel. They are alive, she thought, because they are the physical shape of the action of a living power, of the mind, that had been able to grasp the whole of this complexity, to set its purpose, to give it form. For an instant, it seemed to her that the motors were transparent, and she was seeing the net of their nervous system. It was a net of connections more intricate, more crucial than all of their wires and circuits. The rational connections made by that human mind which had fashioned any one part of them for the first time. They are alive, she thought. But their soul operates them by remote control. Their soul is in every man who has the capacity to equal this achievement. Should the soul vanish from the earth, the motors would stop, because that is the power which keeps them going. Not the oil under the floor under her feet, the oil that would then become primeval ooze again. Not the steel cylinders that would become stains of rust on the walls of the caves of shivering savages. The power of a living mind, the power of thought and choice and purpose. She was making her way back toward the cab, feeling that she wanted to laugh, to kneel, or to lift her arms, wishing she were able to release the things she felt, knowing that it had no form of expression. She stopped. She saw Reardon standing by the steps of the door to the cab. He was looking at her as if he knew why she had escaped and what she felt. They stood still, their bodies becoming a glance that met across a narrow passage. The beating within her was one with the beating of the motors, and she felt as if both came from him. The pounding rhythm wiped out her will. They went back to the cab silently, knowing that there had been a moment which was not to be mentioned between them. The cliffs ahead were a bright liquid gold. Strips of shadow were lengthening in the valleys below. The sun was descending to the peaks in the west. They were going west and up toward the sun. The sky had deepened to the greenish blue of the rails when they saw smokestacks in a distant valley. It was one of Colorado's new towns, the towns that had grown like a radiation from the Wyatt oil fields. She saw the angular lines of modern houses, flat roofs, great sheets of windows. It was too far to distinguish people. In the moment when she thought they would not be watching the train at that distance, a rocket shot out from among the buildings, rose high above the town, and broke as a fountain of gold stars against the darkening sky. Men whom she could not see were seeing the streak of the train on the side of the mountain, and were sending a salute, a lonely plume of fire in the dusk, the symbol of celebration, or of a call for help. Beyond the next turn, in a sudden view of distance, she saw two dots of electric light, white and red, low in the sky. They were not airplanes. She saw the cones of metal girders supporting them. And in the moment when she knew that they were the derricks of Wyatt Oil, she saw that the track was sweeping downward, that the earth flared open, as if the mountains were flung apart. And at the bottom, at the foot of the Wyatt Hill, across the dark crack of a canyon, she saw the bridge of Reardon Metal. They were flying down. She forgot the careful grading, the great curves of the gradual descent. She felt as if the train were plunging downward head first. She watched the bridge growing to meet them, a small square tunnel of metal lacework, a few beams crisscrossed through the air, green, blue, and glowing, struck by a long ray of sunset light from some crack in the barrier of mountains. There were people by the bridge, the dark splash of a crowd, but they rolled off the edge of her consciousness. She heard the rising, accelerating sound of the wheels, and some theme of music, heard to the rhythm of wheels, kept tugging at her mind, growing louder. It burst suddenly within the cab, but she knew that it was only in her mind. The fifth concerto by Richard Halley, she thought. Did he write it for this? Had he known a feeling such as this? They were going faster. They had left the ground, she thought, flung off by the mountains as by a springboard. They were now sailing through space. It's not a fair test, she thought. We're not going to touch that bridge. She saw Reardon's face above her. She held his eyes and her head leaned back, so that her face lay still on the air under his face. They heard a ringing blast of metal. They heard a drum roll under their feet. The diagonals of the bridge went smearing across the windows with the sound of a metal rod being run along the pickets of a fence. Then the windows were too suddenly clear. The sweep of their downward plunge was carrying them up a hill. The derricks of Wyatt Oil were reeling before them. Pat Logan turned, glancing up at Reardon with the hint of a smile, and Reardon said, "That's that." The sign on the edge of a roof read, "Wyatt Junction, she stared, feeling that there was something odd about it, until she grasped what it was. The sign did not move. The sharpest jolt of the journey was the realization that the engine stood still. She heard voices somewhere. She looked down and saw that there were people on the platform. Then the door of the cab was flung open. She knew that she had to be the first to descend, and she stepped to the edge. For the flash of an instant, she felt the slenderness of her own body, the lightness of standing full figure in a current of open air. She gripped the metal bars and started down the ladder. She was halfway down when she felt the palms of a man's hands slammed tight against her ribs and waistline. She was torn off the steps, swung through the air, and deposited on the ground. She could not believe that the young boy laughing in her face was Ellis Wyatt. The tense, scornful face, she remembered, now had the purity, the eagerness, the joyous benevolence of a child in the kind of world for which he had been intended. She was leaning against his shoulder, feeling unsteady on the motionless ground, with his arm about her. She was laughing. She was listening to the things he said. She was answering, "But didn't you know we would?" In a moment she saw the faces around them. They were the bondholders of the John Galt line, the men who were Nielsen Motors, Hammond Cars, Stockton Foundry, and all the others. She shook their hands, and there were no speeches. She stood against Ellis Wyatt, sagging a little, brushing her hair away from her eyes, leaving smudges of soot on her forehead. She shook the hands of the men of the train's crew without words, with the seal of the grins on their faces. There were flashbulbs exploding around them, and men waving to them from the riggings of the oil wells on the slopes of the mountains. Above her head, above the heads of the crowd, the letters TT on a silver shield were hit by the last rays of a sinking sun. Ellis Wyatt had taken charge. He was leading her somewhere, the sweep of his arm cutting a path for them through the crowd, when one of the men with the cameras broke through to her side. "Miss Taggart," he called, "will you give us a message for the public?" Ellis Wyatt pointed at the long string of freight cars. "She has." Then she was sitting in the back seat of an open car driving up the curves of a mountain road. The man beside her was Reardon. The driver was Ellis Wyatt. They stopped at a house that stood on the edge of a cliff with no other habitation anywhere in sight, with the whole of the oil field spread on the slopes below. "Why, of course you're staying at my house overnight, both of you," said Ellis Wyatt as they went in. "Where did you expect to stay?" She laughed. "I don't know. I hadn't thought of it at all. The nearest town is an hour's drive away. That's where your crew has gone. Your boys at the division point are giving a party in their honor. So is the whole town. But I told Ted Nielsen and the others that we'd have no banquets for you and no oratory. Unless you'd like it." "God, no," she said. "Thanks, Ellis." It was dark when they sat at the dinner table in a room that had large windows and a few pieces of costly furniture. The dinner was served by a silent figure in a white jacket, the only other inhabitant of the house, an elderly Indian with a stony face and a courteous manner. A few points of fire were scattered through the room, running over and out beyond the windows, the candles on the table, the lights on the derricks, and the stars. "Do you think that you have your hands full now?" Ellis Wyatt was saying. "Just give me a year and I'll give you something to keep you busy. 2 tank trains a day, Dagny? It's going to be 4 or 6 or as many as you wish me to fill." His hands swept over the lights on the mountains. "This, it's nothing compared to what I've got coming." He pointed west. "The Buena Esperanza Pass, 5 miles from here. Everybody's wondering what I'm doing with it. Oil shale. How many years ago was it that they gave up trying to get oil from shale because it was too expensive? Well, wait till you see the process I've developed. It will be the cheapest oil ever to splash in their faces, and an unlimited supply of it, an untapped supply that will make the biggest oil pool look like a mud puddle. Did I order a pipeline? Hank, you and I will have to build pipelines in all directions, too. Oh, I beg your pardon. I don't believe I introduced myself when I spoke to you at the station. I haven't even told you my name." Reardon grinned. "I've guessed it by now. I'm sorry, I don't like to be careless, but I was too excited." "What were you excited about?" asked Dagny. Her eyes narrowed in mockery. Wyatt held her glance for a moment. His answer had a tone of solemn intensity, strangely conveyed by a smiling voice. "About the most beautiful slap in the face I ever got and deserved." "Do you mean for our first meeting?" I mean for our first meeting. Don't. You were right. I was. About everything but you. Dagny, to find an exception after years of... Oh, to hell with them. Do you want me to turn on the radio and hear what they're saying about the two of you tonight?
No.
Good. I don't want to hear them. Let them swallow their own speeches. They're all climbing on the bandwagon now. We're the band. He glanced at Reardon. What are you smiling at? I've always been curious to see what you're like. I've never had a chance to be what I'm like, except tonight. Do you live here alone like this, miles away from everything? Wyatt pointed at the window. I'm a couple of steps away from everything. What about people? I have guest rooms for the kind of people who come to see me on business. I want as many miles as possible between myself and all the other kinds. He leaned forward to refill their wine glasses. Hank, why don't you move to Colorado? To hell with New York and the Eastern Seaboard. This is the capital of the Renaissance. The second Renaissance, not of oil paintings and cathedrals, but of oil derricks, power plants, and motors made of Reardon metal. They have the Stone Age and the Iron Age, and now they're going to call it the Reardon Metal Age, because there's no limit to what your metal has made possible. I'm going to buy a few square miles of Pennsylvania, said Reardon. The ones around my mills. It would have been cheaper to build a branch here as I wanted, but you know why I can't. And to hell with them, I'll beat them anyway. I'm going to expand the mills, and if she can give me 3-day freight service to Colorado, I'll give you a race for who's going to be the capital of the Renaissance. Give me a year, said Dagny, of running trains on the John Galt line. Give me time to pull the Taggart system together, and I'll give you 3-day freight service across the continent on a Reardon metal track from ocean to ocean. Who was it that said he needed a fulcrum? Said Ellis Wyatt. Give me an unobstructed right-of-way, and I'll show them how to move the earth. She wondered what it was that she liked about the sound of Wyatt's laughter. Their voices, even her own, had a tone she had never heard before. When they rose from the table, she was astonished to notice that the candles were the only illumination of the room. She had felt as if she were sitting in a violent light. Ellis Wyatt picked up his glass, looked at their faces, and said, To the world as it seems to be right now. He emptied the glass with a single movement. She heard the crash of the glass against the wall in the same instant that she saw a circling current, from the curve of his body to the sweep of his arm to the terrible violence of his hand that flung the glass across the room. It was not the conventional gesture meant as celebration. It was the gesture of a rebellious anger, the vicious gesture which his movement substituted for a scream of pain. Ellis, she whispered, what's the matter? He turned to look at her. With the same violent suddenness, his eyes were clear, his face was calm. What frightened her was seeing him smile gently. I'm sorry, he said. Never mind. We'll try to think that it will last. The earth below was streaked with moonlight when Wyatt led them up an outside stairway to the second floor of the house, to the open gallery at the doors of the guest rooms. He wished them good night, and they heard his steps descending the stairs. The moonlight seemed to drain sound as it drained color. The steps rolled into a distant past, and when they died, the silence had the quality of a solitude that had lasted for a long time, as if no person were left anywhere in reach. She did not turn to the door of her room. He did not move. At the level of their feet, there was nothing but a thin railing and a spread of space. Angular tiers descended below with shadows, repeating the steel tracery of derricks, crisscrossing sharp black lines on patches of glowing rock. A few lights, white and red, trembled in the clear air, like drops of rain caught on the edges of steel girders. Far in the distance, 3 small drops were green, strung in a line along the Taggart track. Beyond them, at the end of space, at the foot of a white curve, hung a webbed rectangle, which was the bridge.